So a break now for around 20 minutes, but do not go anywhere. We have a packed interval for you here on Radio 3. The comedian, actor, contemporary music fan John Bird will be talking about the proms he can't wait for this season. I'll be catching up with the harpsichordist Mahanez Fahani as he prepares to unveil his brand new arrangement of Bach's Art of Fugue. That's in a few days' time here at the proms. And right now, we join the historian, Dr. Lucy Worsley. As part of our Sunday night live intervals throughout this prom season, she'll be exploring some of the more unusual things to be found near the Royal Albert Hall. Tonight, she begins her journey at one of the noisiest stretches of traffic in London.
Hyde Park Corner is essentially a massive traffic island, but on its northern side is a mansion. It's an 18th century mansion, but it's most famous as the 19th century home of the Duke of Wellington, Victor of Waterloo, and it also has the world's coolest address. If you write a letter addressed to Number 1 London, that's all you need to put, it should get here. And this year they've got a special exhibition on with some of his most personal, intimate items. Let's go inside. So we're now in the yellow drawing room of Apsley House, and I'm standing with Lord Douro, who is the how many times great-grandson of the first Duke?
I am his great-great-great-grandson.
And you have brought here for display lots of very personal items.
Well, I have felt for many years that there wasn't enough in the house which showed the personality and character and private life of the first Duke of Wellington.
I have to say, this is just what I like. Quirky, personal stuff, like his false teeth. It's brilliant, isn't it? Who'd have thought his false teeth still existed?
I know. I was very excited when I found those.
They're fabulous. Now, these are real human teeth, aren't they?
Set into
a false jaw.
Exactly, with a sort of gold frame to them.
So let's just describe the teeth. We've got what I believe is a considerable number of human teeth. This is more than most people had in their falsies, set into a wooden jaw bone, and the upper and the lower are linked by a spring.
Right.
They look really uncomfortable.
I know. Can you imagine having that in your mouth all day long? It must have been terrible.
Now let's look at this amazing contraption here. Now he was also a little bit deaf, wasn't he?
Well, but he was deaf because a doctor, when he was a young man, had put acid in one of his ears to try and cure some problem, and the result was he went virtually deaf in one ear.
Mm.
And it gave him great pain.
Yeah.
So he had a lot of different hearing devices, and this is one of the more interesting, because it is both a walking stick and a hearing aid, and the handle of the stick is the trumpet, as it were, of the hearing device. People would speak into that open tube, and then there is a small attachment which he put in his ear.
So I love the fact he could be walking along with his stick, da da da. Then someone comes up to him and he would lift the stick up to his ear.
Yeah, exactly.
And they would
shout
into it.
And somebody could talk into it.
He really was such a hero, wasn't he, for his family to take the trouble to keep all of these little, very personal
Every
bits and bobs.
Single thing was kept.
Have you got his toothbrush? Have you got his underpants?
Certainly, all of that. Nothing was thrown away. And we certainly have his underpants, but we certainly also have his toothbrush.
So now we're down in the bowels of Apsley House, and in the gallery here there's a pair of the original wellies. The Duke of Wellington's own boots. They're not made out of rubber, they're leather. And this was his own personal riff on a boot called the Hessian boot, which had quite a sort of dandified tassel hanging off it for the most part. But this is what he got his bootmaker to make. He thought this was comfortable for the battlefield, and when he became terribly famous, they became all the rage and everyone started wearing them. And, you know, they turned into rubber and they survived to this day.
And it is extraordinary that probably to most people, Wellington means a boot more than anything else.
Now we're over in the corner where, on a red cushion, is the Duke of Wellington's death mask, taken just after he died, and it looks like he's having a sleep, doesn't it?
It was taken just after he died, but of course without his false teeth, so the face is, the mouth is very sunk. But the nose and the upper part of the face are undoubtedly correct.
So when you look at cartoons and caricatures and satires of the Duke of Wellington, you think, no way did he have a nose that big, because it's a huge honker in the caricatures. But here we can see that it really was that shape, can't we, in his death mask.
The nose is the nose. It's made of bone. But I always feel so sorry for him to be remembered that is the death mask without the teeth.
Beethoven's rather strange little piece there, Wellington's Victory, quoting, "For he's a jolly good fellow." We heard the historian and chief curator at Historic Royal Palaces, Dr. Lucy Worsley, and she'll be back with another look at places of interest around Kensington next Sunday evening. You're listening to The Proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall. A very warm welcome if you've just tuned in from me, Susie Klein. I am delighted to be joined in the Radio 3 presentation box now by the actor, the comedian and contemporary music fan, John Bird. Is that an accurate description?
Well, I don't know about comedian.
I was thinking more contemporary music fan. I think
yes, that'll do.
I've seen you coming to the Proms for so many years, and you're always here at the ones that many people would think of as rather challenging or difficult, the sort of further corners of repertoire.
I don't like the word. The word challenging is what politicians use when they mean they haven't got an idea about what to do about something. They say it's very challenging.
Okay.
That means it's impossible. But no, contemporary music isn't impossible. Debussy's hardly contemporary.
No, not contemporary. Let's start with Debussy then. What do you make of tonight's Pelléas? Are you a fan of the opera?
I am a great fan of the opera. Debussy is my favourite composer. It's a different thing from saying he's the greatest composer. He's coming up, Beethoven, as far as I'm concerned. But Debussy is my favourite. And it's an excellent performance of a very wonderful score.
And I know you chose Debussy's Je when you were on Desert Island Discs in 2000. What is it then? What are the qualities in Debussy's music that really strike you?
What strikes me is the fluidity. I mean, I don't mean to say it's all kind of watery. What I mean to say is it constantly changes in the most surprising way and takes you by surprise. And Boulez said a great thing about this score, about the Pelléas score. He said Debussy is like a cat who sheaths and unsheaths his claws instantaneously. And it's wonderful, especially for somebody who I don't think likes animals, Richard Boulez. And that's you get these sudden changes of tempo and of texture, which they are in all of Debussy's music.
Let's talk a bit about powerful Pierre, Mr. Boulez himself, because there's so much Boulez coming to the Proms this year. I know you've interviewed him, and just tell me when you first heard of Boulez and what it was about his music that really struck you.
I first heard of Boulez, I suppose, in the late 50s when Le Marteau Saltzmate came out, and I heard that, I think I must have heard it on the radio, and I have in my possession a 10-inch LP. You don't get many of those about. He said, of the Marteau Saltzmate, a French thing conducted by Boulez himself. And to me, it was like having my ears, my brain, and my mind flushed out, and everything is experienced with tremendous clarity and vividness and brio. And that happens whenever I virtually, with one or two exceptions, listen to Boulez.
I mean, that sound world that he created in that piece, Le Marteau Saltzmate, was sort of, he single-handedly created this very trancey sound world of gongs and plucked strings and vibes and xylophone that has been so often imitated since. I mean, it's worth saying that, as we said, a lot of Boulez at the Proms this year, Anthème, Le Marteau Saltzmate, Memorial, and the piece I call Dérive de.
Dérive de.
But you laughed at me before.
I do laugh because it sounds like something out of The Simpsons. Dérive de.
And you call it?
Dérive 2, I call it.
I'll let you have it as Dérive.
God, you know, I was trying to keep the English. Dérive 2. Dérive 2 is an amazing work. It's quite long, and it's for, I think, 11 players. And to be able to see these players knock themselves out, getting around these notes, will be in itself something to work. I mean, Boulez likes all these big display. I mean, he likes even, you know, seeing the instruments lined up on the bass. And he certainly, that's the case with Derivde. Sorry, I said Derivde then.
I've got you
Derive
out of
it. Two.
Going, well, here we go. A little taster of Derivde 2 right now. The Ensemble Intercontemporain and Daniel Corker conducting part of Pierre Boulez's Derive 2. You can hear that at the Proms next Friday. That's part of Daniel Barenboim, the West Eastern Divans concert, where they're also going to be starting their complete Beethoven symphony cycle. Lots of pairing of Beethoven and Boulez coming up during this 2012 Proms season. John Bird, people do think of Pierre Boulez. They do think difficult music, but yes, you take issue with that. It's not difficult.
I do take issue with it, part because it's so varied. You can't say that. But I mean, the stuff that's coming up in the Proms now, if you take Message Esquisse, the piece for solo cello with six cellos in it, that is a piece which Boulez himself invokes the name of, the most unlikely name, of Paganini as one of the sources, because he likes the virtuosity, Paganini, and what he called the insane virtuosity of the Chopin B-flat minor sonata, which...
We've asked you, I'm going to interrupt, because we've asked you not only to look at Boulez, but also just to kind of cast your eye across the next week of the Proms schedule and pick out a favourite. And what you've picked is Sibelius 7th Symphony. We're going to be hearing that with Juan Jomena conducting the BBC Philharmonic this Tuesday. Why Sibelius 7?
Because it was the first classical record I ever bought. I was working at Mrs. Johnson's record shop when I was at school on Saturday mornings, and I bought the 7th Symphony in 78, and one at a time, one Saturday at a time. I think there were four 78s. And I used to be able, when I had the CD, I used to be able to remember when I turned over the 78.
So you leap up at the appropriate point.
It was. And good. So far from being a one-movement symphony, it was, in fact, an eight-movement. I mean, literally an eight-movement symphony.
And very good exercise,
for
no
me,
doubt,
yes.
As well.
And the Art of Fugue is coming up, which... one of the things that people don't really seem to know about Boulez is that he quotes Bach as his model. That he said Bach is his model, not particularly the Art of Fugue, but the Klavierübung, because of, wonderful Boulez word, the proliferation of ideas, which comes from something very simple.
You've also chosen Bach's Art of Fugue, I know, in
yes,
your time
I
on things
too.
Like Desert Island Discs. One of the things that we are highlighting in this Proms season is this notion of trailblazing in this Olympic year, game-changing works, the kind of works that change the landscape of music forever. What is it about the Art of Fugue that has struck people ever since it was written as this almost perfect work, even though it was somehow just brought together almost by accident?
Is it because it's a complete mystery? It's one of the great miracles, is the Marie Celeste of music. There is something, nobody knows what instrument should play it. Nobody even knows whether any instrument should play it, whether it's not meant to be played at all. It's like a lot of Bach's instrumental music, it seems, when you hear it, it is like music writing itself.
We're going to hear a little more about this piece now, because next Saturday, the former Radio 3 New Generation artist, the harpsichord player Mohannes Vahane, is going to be unveiling his new arrangement of Bach's mysterious magnum opus. I don't know if you're going to be there to hear it, John, but it's going to be an absolutely sensational concert. I caught up with Mahan earlier this week. I asked him why, in his opinion, the Art of Fugue is such an important piece.
Well, Bach's Art of Fugue, and I think, like so much of Bach's music, ends up being trailblazing and monumental in the history of music quite by chance, in a way. There's always an aura around Bach's music that he doesn't quite intend for it to have posterity, but it just sort of happens. Part of that, of course, is the context in which it's written. You know, people thought that ancient music was something, you know, maybe 30 or 40 years old, and they didn't have the expectation that it would sort of outlast them. But also, it's actually a great tribute to antiquity. It's not a tribute to modernity in the slightest. It's literally that, the art of fugue, the craft of fugue. It's Bach's testament to the form that he had, I think quite consciously, perfected throughout his lifetime. And he shows in this tribute to the past a totally new way of looking at music, the idea that the fugue, which even in its own time was thought to be antiquated and thought to be dry, that the mathematics of the fugue, if you like, can create true beauty, and a beauty that was unknown even by the sort of more modern styles that were surrounding Bach. And I think that's really the perfect dialectic, if you like, between the past and the future. And Bach does this so effortlessly. If you like, Bach is the original cool.
What is it that Bach does with those ideas that elevates them to such an iconic piece of music, then?
Well, I think, you know, by this point, fugue had become a flavor that composers would use in order to say, quite literally, look at me, I'm writing a fugue. But, you know, a composer like Handel or Telemann, after, you know, maybe 10 or 20 bars, a fugue would just become like any other piece and basically in a two-part texture. You can see this in Handel's Concerti Grossi, for example, his keyboard works. The fugue is just an idea, and that's that. Bach is really, you know, the figure that sees the fugue all the way through. The counterpoint is always perfect. I think any of us who is in music has taken a course in writing fugue knows that it's easy to start a fugue, but to develop it and to finish it with perfection is very difficult. And I think Bach's remarkable contribution in the Art of Fugue is, well, firstly, to use different versions of the theme. He inverts it, he augments it, he diminishes it, he adds new themes, sort of counter themes to it. And, you know, it's like an encyclopedia. I really think that a performance of the Art of Fugue is like opening up the Oxford English Dictionary and reading it out loud.
Let's look ahead to some of the other trailblazing, game-changing works in this season's Proms. What are you looking forward to most?
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to Nixon in China, conducted by the composer himself. And I've listened to this opera many times, but I've actually never had the pleasure of seeing it live. And that's a very exciting prospect. It could not have come sooner to the Proms. I really admire this work, and I'm very much looking forward to it. And tonight's piece, Pelléas and Mélisande, is particularly exciting to me, not only as a lover of Debussy's music, but also, if you like, as a talking head for Baroque music. You know, Debussy was involved in the making of the Rameau edition in the early 20th century, and was very much interested in Rameau's music, and I think there's a lot to be considered about what was the influence of Rameau's composition and Rameau's orchestration, which Debussy and Dandy and many of their contemporaries viewed as a very French style of composition. I think there's to be considered what effect that Rameau had on this piece.
We heard Tom Copeland playing Contrapuntus 4 from Bach's Art of Fugue. And you can hear the piece in its entirety, Mahan Esfahani's new arrangement of this trailblazing work, next Saturday at the Cadogan Hall in London, 3 p.m. It is, like every prom, live here on BBC Radio 3.